from the Madison area, from Blue Mountains, Wisconsin, who's served on a chronic wasting disease stakeholder panel and other conservation efforts in the state, and also Jason Fleener, and he's the assistant big game ecologist with our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they're tasked with the management of deer in our state. Each of our presenters is going to show a PowerPoint presentation to start out, and then we'll get into the question and answer period. And we're going to hear Don's presentation first. I'll advance the slides, and we've asked them to keep them to 10 minutes maximum. Yeah. Don?
Thanks very much, and a pleasure to be here. I want to make 10 points about deer and ask three questions. And I guess I could summarize that by asking, can we buck the trend? First, next slide. It's important to note that people love deer. It's as though Bambi were blessed from on high. We are sort of indoctrinated from a young age to recognize what a beautiful animal deer are. It's the only large mammal most of us are likely to see in the woods, regularly at any rate. People love deer so much they regularly feed them and enjoy watching them. They're less fond of them when they run into them on the roads. We'll get to that in a moment. But they're also the backbone of our state wildlife management programs in terms of the hunter interest they elicit and, of course, the revenues they generate from license sales. Deer are also a dangerous nuisance. This is the Mr. Hyde side of deer. Deer ticks act as a vector for Lyme disease. We know that bovine tuberculosis is spread by deer in parts of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. We don't want bovine tuberculosis in the dairy state. We had an outbreak starting in 2002, I believe it was, of chronic wasting disease. I have one colleague who describes deer now as rats with antlers, so you can see a rather different view of deer has emerged. In terms of chronic wasting disease management, we've had a gross failure of state policies. And that efforts to eradicate the disease and control and contain it have failed, with progressive spread of the disease out from its original outbreak source. And most of that was related to skepticism about the seriousness of the disease and the lack of cooperation by private landowners to eradication efforts, and hunter resistance to some extent too. We also have a problem with deer car collisions creating public nuisance in many areas. Deer, typically between 40 and 60,000 deer are hit each year on the highways of Michigan and Wisconsin each. One in every 39 drivers in West Virginia, they have the record right now, is likely to hit a deer in the next 12 months. In other words, about every 26 seconds, somebody in America hits a deer on the highway. And this is not just a case of property damage. They cause hundreds of injuries and dozens of deaths each year as well. Now, the third point I want to make about deer is that they respond to habitat conditions and can multiply fast. This was Aldo Leopold's essential insight. The way to manage game, he said, is to manage habitat. In particular, as you can see either from Keith McCaffrey's three-dimensional graph here or the placemat I got at Nick's Family Restaurant in Spooner, Wisconsin, deer respond positively to young aspen stands and to grassy openings, as well as farm fields, of course. In many populations, deer begin to reproduce at age one. Twinning rates have increased over recent years. Mild winters have probably contributed to this. But the net result, next slide, is that deer populations have grown and grown and grown. Predation is now mostly limited to cars and tightly regulated hunting to the point where, next slide, deer populations have soared. Now, this is not a local phenomenon. It's not a temporary phenomenon, and it's not a minor phenomenon. Deer populations are now overabundant throughout most of the northeastern, midwestern, southeastern, and southern U.S. Sitka black-tailed deer are hyperabundant in parts of the West Coast. It's a chronic problem across much of the continent, and not just North America. They're dealing with deer overabundance in Europe and Australia as well. Next slide. Here in Wisconsin, we have despite extended deer hunts, efforts by the DNR to enhance hunting of does and bring down the deer population, we remain above target goal densities in most of the deer management units in the state. And some have begun to question whether deer, whether the DNR has lost the ability with hunting to really regulate deer numbers. Now, my sixth point here is that deer eat plants, about 6 to 8 pounds a day. They have a broad diet, but they also have favorites. And because deer are in the woods 24/7, they're eating a lot of plants in a lot of different areas. And this is beginning to have profound effects on forest plant species composition. Canada ewe has been described as ice cream for deer, and ewe has disappeared from most of its original habits in northern Wisconsin. The Ojibwe word for ewe is that which grows everywhere, but it doesn't anymore. It's restricted to Indian reservations and a couple of the Apostle Islands. You can see what happened to trillium populations in northern Illinois there. And we also have obvious evidence for overabundant deer in terms of these sandwich trees and conspicuous browse line and the condition of this fenced exclosure at Folds Creek and inside a deer yard. My seventh point here is that deer browsing kills trees, in particular baby cedars and hemlocks and several other species. We've done research in my group about this for some years now. And cedar swamps are special because they're habitats for many of the state's rarest plants, including this ram's head lady slipper. They're also very slow-growing trees because in the wintertime, deer depend on conifer browse for survival. They tend to favor cedar stands and hemlock stands and often browse them to death. And you can see that there's a conspicuous difference here in terms of the demographic profiles of seedling populations in the national forest, which have virtually disappeared, and nearby Indian reservations in the state. And that's an interesting observation and an important one. Baby hemlocks are also being hammered by deer to the point where many hemlock forests have reverted to hardwood stand types now. We're beginning to lose conifer representation in the upper Midwest. And the next slide shows that deer are not restricting their attention to sensitive, slow-growing conifers. They're also wiping out populations of many other hardwood and softwood trees across much of the upper Midwest. Leading to my eighth point, that when you have few predators, cold winters, and favorable habitat conditions all favoring increased abundances of deer, you can expect deer to be having the massive consequences they are having in the woods right now. Forests are changing, as I said, not only in Wisconsin, but across much of the United States. Many different forests are being profoundly altered in their composition because of chronic deer browsing now. I'm also very concerned with what's happening to plant diversity. Most of the diversity in a forest is not in the overstory, it's in the understory, the herbaceous plants. We've got state parks specifically set aside to preserve nature that have hemorrhaged, that have lost more than half their plant diversity in the last 50 years, our research has shown. Madeline Island at 60 deer per square mile is virtually has no understory in the forest left at all. And interestingly, we don't see any declines in what I would call control areas, islands in the Apostles that don't have deer and Indian reservations that are have consistently lower deer densities than most of the other lands in the state. The particular species we're losing are the pretty wildflowers, primarily, the things that many of us like to see, as well as those sensitive tree species and seedlings. Leading to my 10th point, that what we have with white-tailed deer are not just a pretty animal to feed in the winter, not just a fun game animal to hunt, but in fact a keystone herbivore acting within complex forest ecosystems to radically change the current and future composition of these forests for decades, possibly centuries to come. What are the long-term impacts of browsing? I think we can look into the future if we visit the Allegheny Plateau in Pennsylvania, where forests that used to be diverse and multi-storied are converting into what are referred to locally there as fern parks. Visiting similar chronically browsed forests in Europe, Aldo Leopold called them Devonian forests because they had only spruce in the overstory and these ancient ferns in the understory. So my three questions I'll leave you with are, first, why aren't state departments of natural resources coping more effectively with deer overabundance? Why have efforts to boost the take of antlerless animals and does failed? Why are many hunter groups so against earn a buck? Why do we have so much resistance in general to the idea of taking animals? You can argue that hunter populations are down, hunters are aging, we don't have enough hunters in the woods. Next slide. We also, oops, that buck's thing has shifted position, but you can get an idea from the width of that bracket that most hunters prefer to take bucks. They take great pride in taking an animal with a big rack of antlers. And we have habits and culture associated with hunting that were better suited to the early 20th century when we were trying to get deer populations to recover from very low levels and extirpation, in fact, in many regions. And those habits and culture that made every sense in the early 20th century make no sense in a world of hyperabundant deer that we have today. Leading to my last question of whether we'll ever succeed in being able to use science to manage deer and forest together as an ecosystem. I think there are signs of hope here. Pennsylvania in particular has done very systematic studies of the severity of their deer overabundance problem and are taking steps to try and address it with enhanced use of scientific resources. And here in Wisconsin, we've just begun a similar initiative. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Jason Fleener, the assistant big game ecologist with the Department of Natural Resources here in Wisconsin.
All right, well, good morning. Did you know that when most hunters in Wisconsin are asked if deer hunting was taken away from, they'd say they'd miss that more than anything else? Deer hunting in Wisconsin is a very, very important tradition that many people value across the state. And I'm here today to talk a little bit about the deer management program from the perspective of the natural resources. Some of these slides might look familiar. This is a pretty good segue from Don's presentation. So, what is deer management based on in Wisconsin? The foundation is built upon deer population goals, and those drive our management decisions. If you look at this graph, you'll see the pink line in the middle represents the post-hunt population estimates after the season, and the goal or the target is the yellow line at the bottom. So you can see throughout the 70s and 80s we're pretty on target with goal, but it's slowly slipped away from a statewide perspective. However, regionally this varies quite a bit, and that can be some of the confusion about population estimates and goals. So in Wisconsin Administrative Code NR 115, the department shall seek to maintain a deer herd balance with its range and a deer population goals reasonably compatible with social, economic, and ecosystem objectives for each deer management unit. Now, our job is to try to combine all three of those things at the end, and that's it's quite a challenge. So what factors into deer population goals? First, well, ecological carrying capacity, more or less the number of deer the landscape can support, or the highest level of deer that landscape can support over a long period of time. And if you're at ecological carrying capacity, that's the threshold, and usually deer populations are not as healthy. So we try to manage below those levels. Also, a huge thing is hunter success and satisfaction. Cooperation with hunters is critical, so we need to balance some of these things. Some of the ecological and economic impacts, forestry, farming, also ecological impacts, some of the ones that Don mentioned with sustainable forestry and plant diversity. Disease transmission, CWD is a big issue, chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin right now. Manage population goals in consideration for healthy deer herds to minimize disease risks. deer vehicle collisions. Essentially, everyone who drives is at risk in the state, so we need to consider public safety. Also, tribal rights from the Ojibwe or Chippewa tribes, ability to keep the herd. Ag goal, basically, you need to set it at a level where hunters can sustain the population. If it's too high, eventually the deer herd will keep increasing to the level where they cannot be managed no longer. Tolerable levels of egg damage. Crop damage from farmers, important economic value. So what are the other building blocks to the program? Deer management units. Each management unit has its own predefined population goal. And to get to goals, we need to monitor the population through surveys. In other words, our population modeling, which is built mainly upon harvest data from registration. Those will build a population estimate, and then we will decide the season framework and quotas for the following season to achieve those goals in the future. So these are all the factors that go into population goals. Again, you can more or less divide them into two different categories. One's the ecological, one's the social. And a lot of those variables influence each other in the end. So one thing in the ecological category that I didn't cover at the previous slide is maximum sustainable yield. In other words, this is the level below carrying capacity in which hunters can maintain a consistent harvest year after year after year. So this is mainly what influences our northern and central forest population goals. If you look over on the social interest side, most of these factors influence population goals in southern farmland units. Generally, farmland areas are capable of holding more deer per deer habitat. But at those levels, oftentimes are not acceptable with society. So hunters oftentimes want more deer, while many of these other groups want fewer deer. So our job is to try to balance those. Recently, we went through a deer management unit review process for goals, and this occurs about every 3 years. So within the next year, we may see some population goals increasing for some deer management units in the state. So how do we get to goals? Well, it's through managed hunting. Hunting is what achieves those goals, and really there are not many other effective strategies to do that. So through hunting, we manipulate the antlerless harvest, which drives the population one way or another through season frameworks, quotas, and tagging systems. Some areas like CWD units in the state have very liberal hunting regulations or tagging frameworks, unlimited antlerless harvest with the caveat of having to harvest a buck first, also called earn a buck. And on the other end of the spectrum, in the northern part of the state, there's some areas with the zero antlerless quota, so many gun hunters will only have the opportunity to shoot a buck this year. So again, who manages the herd? Landowners and hunters both influence this. The DNR simply provides the tools to hunters and landowners to use, and it's up to them if they want to use them. So some of the challenges we face in deer management in the state today: hunters want more deer oftentimes than what's established at goal. These values can conflict with management practices and programs. There's a variety of views on how deer should be managed. I think this is increasing every day. Even just within the hunting community itself, there's you have bow hunters, gun hunters, muzzleloader hunters, and it's different seasons, and that's becoming more of an issue. And then there's the non-hunting community. And then also, hunters have to share the woods with different recreationalists and hunters themselves, and oftentimes this creates conflict, and we need to try to figure out the best solution to find a compromise. Also, land fragmentation and land access. In Wisconsin especially, land is becoming more fragmented. Parcel sizes of properties are becoming smaller and more divided. And in essence, you have a smaller area to hunt. Land access becomes more constricted. Price of hunting land, hunting leases, increasing. Also influences who hunts where and when. Believability of deer population estimates. Often this is a matter of perspective. Again, goals are, or rather estimates are built upon deer management units. And many times hunters see it in the eyes of what's around them. So this is in the chronic wasting disease area. These are helicopter surveys conducted last December. Each one of those squares represents one square mile, and the objective is to try to count every deer as possible within those units. So the numbers within those squares represents the number of deer counted. You can see why a hunter might not believe a population estimate by the way that they average. Deer per square mile of deer range or suitable habitat was 34 deer per square mile last winter. However, if you look at the top of the screen, you see a lot of zeros in there, ones, twos, and fours. So if you're hunting in that area, that can be very easy to not believe the population estimates. However, if you go kind of in the center part of the screen, you can see 186, 104, 128 deer per square mile that were actually counted. And that's only a few miles away from a 1 and a 12 I see there. So deer distribution can vary quite a bit. Another challenge is the declining rate of people in the population who participate in hunting. This is going to influence deer management in the future. This is from University of Wisconsin's Applied Population Lab. Basically, on this graph is different segments of the hunting community. Between 2004 and 2007, you can see the changes in the rates of people participating in various hunting. You see in the middle of the graph, or the chart rather, there's a decline in some of these groups. This is the biggest cohort or largest segment in the hunting community, basically the baby boomers. That's what we're most concerned about. However, on a positive note, you see that more hunters over the age of 65 are participating in hunting than they have in the past. Also, some of the youth groups and the female or women segment of the population is participating more in hunting than they have in the past as well, so that's a positive. Other challenges is finding and relating shared values. A lot of times there's a disconnect between the DNR and hunters. The goal is to try to find what we have in common and to work together to accomplish goals. Back one slide. Also, disease management, chronic wasting disease, trying to find a middle ground for how the population should be managed involves a lot of compromise. There's a lot of viewpoints on this matter. Management plans currently being reviewed on chronic wasting disease. Baiting and feeding deer is a big issue in Wisconsin. It affects deer movement. Also, disease management as well, disease risks. Sustainability, this is a big deal, whether if you're talking about the deer herd, forestry, or ecosystem management. Thank you.
Can you just turn off the front, maybe, in case they want to write back there? Is there a way to shut half?
The fluorescence. Oh. The incandescence on in the back.
Can you turn the back lights on?
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
That's good.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. And one of the last challenges I mentioned was adapting to changing deer populations. This has happened so fast within the last few decades. It's basically a resistance to change. Many hunters are used to one season framework or tagging system in the past, and it's very difficult based on tradition to adapt to those changes in the deer herd population. So at this time, would you like to take questions now or at the end?
We'll do questions at the end.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Thank you, Jason. And our third presenter is Tony Grabsky. Tony is a hunter and landowner and member of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress who lives, about 20 miles from here, Tony?
Actually, about 30.
30. And so thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks to the conference organizers for giving me this chance to talk to you this morning. And I wanted to say that I am a member of the Conservation Congress and several other hunter and landowner groups, but the opinions today are not definite positions of those groups, so I was instructed to qualify my presentation a little bit before I got here. But these collected viewpoints are shared by a lot of hunters and landowners, at least out where I live, and I also grew up in northern Wisconsin, so I have a pretty good feel for deer hunting in the state. The criticisms I have about deer management also can be rather severe towards our state agency, the Department of Natural Resources, and I've worked with a lot of good people up there, and they do many good things for the state as well, so this just happens to be one policy that I disagree with. This was a photo from back in 1977, my first buck, and it shows some of the deer hunting tradition that goes back a long way to my childhood, and I have the classic green and gold Packer hat, and even though this is a small buck back then, it was monstrous to me, and probably one of my most memorable hunts in the big family gas-guzzling station wagon in the back. So the rule book back then was pretty simple, only 25 pages, and there wasn't a lot of complication, and people could just go out there and hunt and register their deer, and that was about it. Next. So now I say my last buck. Well, I said that because a few years after I moved west to Madison out near Blue Mounds, CWD was discovered in my area, and the initial policy back then was to try to eradicate all the deer from that zone. So I thought that this might be the last buck I'd ever shoot out there, and you can see a little bit by the size of the antlers that my changing perspective over my years of hunting. Now this is a trophy, and hunters do have a fascination with giant racks. Next. And along with that, the rules are now a lot more complicated. So the rule book now is over twice as thick as it used to be. It's 55 pages, and hunting has become very complicated, especially in the CWD zones where there's multiple season frameworks, different rules, earn a buck. The season dates have changed almost yearly, and a lot of farmers out there say, well, hunting's just way too complicated. I don't have time for all this foolishness. They just want to go out and shoot a few deer and get back to their field work. Next. So what happened in the CWD zones? I've called it a failed attempt at forced deer herd reduction, and both of the previous speakers have made very good points about deer overpopulation, and disease can certainly be one consequence of that. And hunters are one of the primary means to control the deer population, but I think in this case the agency kind of went about it in the wrong way and tried to force hunters and landowners in that zone to shoot the deer herd down more than they wanted to, and I think it's that program has backfired. Next. So the original zone was about 4,000 square miles. It actually started out as only about 113 when they first found it, and it was viewed as a point of infection of this disease. And I don't know if you know a lot about CWD, but it's a TSE disease called transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. So you can say that five times fast. And it's related to mad cow disease and scrapie in sheep. And it causes holes to form in the brain. Eventually the animals get sick and die. But people thought that this could have been out there for years. We've been eating these deer, and we don't see a lot of sick deer, so what's the big concern over it? So the zone was about 4,000 square miles, and they said, well, there's no way we're going to kill all the deer in that large of an area. Next. Well, now the zone is greater than 10,000 square miles. So with more testing, the number of positives, and a lot of researchers or people that are studying CWD term this spread. Well, it could also in many cases just be increased detection, that the harder you look for something, the more you're going to find it. So some of it sure could be due to spread, but also increased testing and detection. Next. Another rule that was implemented the first year CWD was found was banning baiting and feeding throughout the state. And baiting and feeding has some avid supporters and a lot of people opposed to it for a wide variety of reasons: spreading disease, concentrating deer, giving deer more food than they need. But many hunters, especially in the north, use deer baiting as a tool to attract deer in, get cleaner kills, and be able to harvest deer easier, especially in places where there aren't a lot of deer. And in the CWD zones, it's illegal throughout those zones because of the possibility of spreading the disease at concentrating areas where the bait stations are. But one reason that baiting is used by the agency is that it's viewed as an effective tool to harvest more deer. So hunters say, well, if the agency can use baiting to harvest deer over their bait stations with sharpshooting, why aren't we allowed to use it? And it's kind of a hypocritical policy from their standpoint. Next. These are the actual CWD detection numbers that have been measured throughout Wisconsin, and you can see why many hunters and landowners, even those that live in the center of the eradication zone, as it was earlier termed, don't feel CWD is that big of a problem when it's only affecting about 1% of the deer population right in the management area. But statewide, it's less than 1%, and actually less than 100 deer that tested positive actually looked sick, had the visible symptoms of CWD. Next. And here's trail cameras are a way that hunters in modern day hunting practices do self-monitoring of the deer herds on their properties. So these are some trail camera photos just taken off of my property this year, and we haven't photographed any sickly looking deer, and there's thousands of these trail cameras out there and millions of photos taken, and as I said, most of the deer look totally healthy, even if some of them are testing positive. Next. So was there another agenda behind the CWD policy? And many hunters and landowners felt that CWD was just being used as a vehicle to accomplish these other things that have become issues with deer management. One is to ban baiting and feeding statewide. Another one would be to eliminate commercial deer and elk farms, to measure the public's response to extreme deer herd reduction tactics, forcibly lower the deer population in areas significantly above overwinter goals, reduce deer overabundance associated problems such as deer vehicle accidents, forest and crop damage and disease, and then finally to create new sources of revenue and employment for the DNR, UW, and Veterinary Diagnostics Lab because of all the testing and grant money coming in. Next. So these were several of the management concerns and failures that some of these groups that I'm affiliated with saw through the CWD management policy. The state has spent over $35 million since 2002 on CWD eradication efforts. The zone has expanded to 20 counties and over 10,000 square miles in Wisconsin and also several thousand miles in northern Illinois. Deer harvest totals in the CWD zones have decreased from 10-year averages, and the overall incidence rate has remained unchanged. National experts agree that CWD eradication from wild deer populations is not possible, and a very negative influence on the agency itself was that public trust has been diminished, and especially in their faith over deer management methods. Severe deer depopulation efforts have had long-term negative effects on hunting cultures and traditions. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people just say the fun is gone from hunting. There's fewer hunters, less deer are being killed, and the quality of the hunt has been diminished because of all these rules and forced methods to manage the deer herd as a consequence of the disease. Next. So the policy alienated the landowners because at the initial public meeting, they came out and said, we need to eradicate all the deer and CWD and reduce the population to as close as zero as possible. And this was a quote one of the employees actually used, that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. If you don't eradicate deer, then sharpshooters and extreme measures will do the job. And it was even threatened that helicopter shooting would go on. And the landowners right away started to take this adversarial view that a lot of them paid hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars for their properties. And some of them have these properties for recreational use for deer hunting, and they were not going to eliminate the deer population after paying that amount of money for their land, and they felt that they should be able to use their land as they saw fit. So I guess the battle lines were drawn. Next. So a hunter and landowner group formed called Citizens and Landowners for a Rational Response to CWD, and this wasn't just a bunch of uneducated redneck hunters. I have a PhD. There was a couple of retired professors. There was a multimillionaire backing us with financial funding, several large commercial farmers, and even a famous author of deer and deer hunting books and magazines participated. Next. And we had a grassroots effort, and we weren't saying that we would not kill any deer. We were opposed to total herd annihilation. So we went around and recruited people to fill in our map, and these are plat book sections, and everything colored in is where the landowners had decided they were not going to eradicate. Next. And we actually published a newsletter. Next. So deer are viewed as very valuable and charismatic animals by hunters, not pests to be killed for the dumpster. These are some of my favorite quotes from Aldo Leopold about eradication. And this first one, there was an episode in Florida where there was a tick carrying a deer tick fever, and deer were one of the vehicles for that fever. So the plan was to eradicate all the deer because of this deer tick. And he said that the episode showed that a scientific bureau confronted with the question of wildlife eradication may prefer to lose the wildlife than to lose time in scientific research for alternatives. In one sense, this is water over the dam, but in another, it carries a lesson for the future. At best, the scientific base in this case was sketchy, and no imagination had been used in searching for less destructive alternatives. It's time for us to learn caution and restraint in our power to eradicate wild things. And then the last one, the last quote is from a book that most of you had received a copy of when you registered, the San County Almanac. The land is one organism. Its parts, like our own parts, compete with each other and cooperate with each other. The competitions are as much a part of the inner workings as the cooperations. You can regulate them cautiously, but not abolish them. Next. So these are some of the closing things to think about when we get into the question and answer session. I think CWD opened the eyes of the DNR to deer and people management problems. Deer management and deer-derived revenue directed the state of Wisconsin in the early days of management towards higher and higher population goals and eventual overpopulation. Decades-old deer management and hunting practices are now obsolete, and large tracts of public land are now gone. Hunter numbers are significantly declining. So I think the real problem isn't CWD, but finding more effective, socially acceptable, and economical methods to manage the deer as a public resource on private property. And finally, hunters and landowners must be compensated in some way more than the thrill of the hunt and possibility for trophy deer and venison if they're expected to harvest more deer than they really want to and open their land to public access. Next. So here's a cartoon that I think I might actually taken out of the Milwaukee Journal, Paul. It says, hunters will likely become extinct long before deer. And the caption says, as predicted by a UW sociologist in the 90s, the deer hunter dwindled in number and finally became extinct by 2050. And then in the diorama, there's your classic hunter with his, it says, Wisconsin hunter, Urbanus hunter Wisconsinitis, and he has his empty beer can and pack of smokes on the ground there, and all the deer are studying him. Next. So that's all I have for you this morning.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you to all our presenters, and we'll open the session now to question and answers. Please, when you rise to state a question and give us your name and affiliation.
This question is for Don Waller, and I'm Jordan Fisher Smith. I'm a freelancer, and I'm working on a book for Random House and some magazine jobs and some other things. Don, can you characterize, if you know, the health of ecosystem health of areas where there are healthy wolf populations in the border states of the upper Midwest, if you have any association with those areas, in comparison to the areas you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jordan. He was asking how the ecosystem health of forests compares in areas that have healthy wolf populations to areas that don't have these predators present. And there's a lot of interest in this question right now. Ecologists refer to it as cascading trophic interactions or top-down control. There's been a lot of publicity associated with reductions in the elk population in Yellowstone, for example, with increases in the wolf population in that ecosystem and associated declines, or rather improvements in tree regeneration and ecosystem health there. There are efforts right now that have begun here in the Midwest to assess that question, to look at areas with and without wolf packs to see if forests are recovering better. And there's some preliminary evidence that has not been published yet to suggest that that's the case. I think that's a very interesting and important question, the role of natural predators. If human hunters are tightly regulated, preferring to shoot bucks, only hunting for 9 days out of the year, unwilling or unable to get into very backcountry locations, especially wilderness areas and remote parks and so forth, then I think natural predators could form a very important part of the question. Ecologists are gaining a lot of new appreciation for the power of predators and their importance in ecosystem health. This is something, of course, that Leopold beat everyone else to, again, you know, by 50 years or so. And his wisdom, you know, the thinking like a mountain essay that goes into the role of predators and their effects on plant regeneration and ecosystem health, that attitude was questioned for a long time. And when I was training myself as an ecologist, it was sort of ridiculed as saying, well, you know, bottom up is more important, or predators are just scavengers that can't wait for their meat to die and things like that. But In fact, we have pretty good evidence now that predators have important top-down effects. I can give you some references on that, some recent papers. But I think it's a very important part of the equation.
Next question.
I'm Tyler Bowser. I'm a senior at Kansas State University. I was just wondering, and Jason, you mentioned in your PowerPoint that they're increasing the prices in deer tags and making it more difficult for hunters to hunt. Why are they doing that if it's such an overpopulation? Or do you know why?
The question was about the increasing cost and complexity and difficulty for hunters to participate.
The first part of your question regarding deer tags, I can't say that the price has really significantly increased within recent history, within the last few years. The recent budget cycle, the prices of hunting licenses are going to remain the same as they have been in recent years due to the economy. However, that's changed over the last several years with inflation. But as far as the regulations goes, yes, it is getting more complex. There's a variety of variables going into that. A lot of it has to do with the changing society within the hunting community. There's a lot of exceptions, ifs, ands, or buts that people are advocating for. A lot of the deer management regulations and policies are ultimately approved by the legislature. So a lot of the complexities result in increased opportunity. However, a lot of it on the other end of the spectrum has to do with precision or precise management on a small level. And to get to those goals, there's more detail involved. So it's evolving quite a bit.
Yes?
Katie Unger with the Wildlife Society. I was just wondering, there was a report in Nature that came out a couple months ago that showed that even apparently healthy deer can have infected feces and potentially distribute the disease that way. So I was just wondering for Jason if that's affected the way that you're going about this at all. And I also wanted to ask Tony, you know, you showed those photos of deer taken by trail cameras and said, you know, these deer look fairly healthy. I just wonder what you make of that. I mean, what does that show to you?
The question is about CWD being found in deer feces and the ability to transmit the disease from relatively healthy-looking deer.
Okay. Yes, I did hear about the research recently. It's very interesting. Also, they found that prions or the protein that causes chronic wasting disease is found in saliva too for deer. So there's multiple transmission methods.
I'm sorry, in what?
So there's multiple transmission methods
in saliva and feces.
In saliva and feces.
Saliva.
Yep. The challenge with CWD or chronic wasting disease is that a deer can become infected, and it may take a very long time for that deer to exhibit classical symptoms that one would see as a sick deer. However, the average age of the Wisconsin whitetail is relatively young, maybe 2 to 3 years of age, and at our current harvest rates, more deer are harvested before they show those classical symptoms, so they may be spreading the disease while they appear to be healthy still. So that's one of the very big challenges we face.
So I'll address the same question. With those trail camera photos, I think that's where some of the skepticism of the hunters and landowners came about, telling us that it was a huge problem. And early models showed that within 5 to 10 years, hundreds of deer would be dying in our area, and to the effect that you wouldn't be able to walk through the woods because of the rotting carcasses. Well, many of us felt that this disease could have been around for a really long time, and since the technology evolved to finally test for it, when they tested for it, they found it. And most of the scientific literature initiates the article with CWD, a disease that's a highly transmissible disease that's always fatal. But there's been very little actual hard scientific evidence that convinces me of that. One researcher on the UW campus actually proposed in her collared deer tracking study to where they were trapping deer, putting radio collars on them, and when they trapped them, they'd do a tonsil biopsy and test the animal if it was CWD positive or not. And this researcher wanted to leave some of those positive deer on the landscape and study them and see how their home ranges would change, how long it took them to develop clinical symptoms, if they all indeed did die, and that was not allowed. So once the deer was found to be positive, instead of studying it, it was immediately killed or tracked down with the collar and killed. So I think that the possibility is out there that I think animals could test positive and not all die. And until I'm convinced otherwise by the scientific literature, I'll hold that view.
Thank you. Next question. Yes, right here.
I'm Dave Spratt from Great Northern Outdoors. It's a web magazine. Question is for Don. What's the difference between the reservations and everywhere else? I mean, they have low deer densities there. What are they doing?
Thank you. The question is about forest health on deer on the Native American reservations and the differences there versus other places with lower deer density.
Right. There is conspicuously lower deer density. In the Menominee, it's estimated around 9 or 10 per square mile. Lac des Flambeaux and Lac Coeur d'Oreille and Bad River are a bit above that. But anyway, what are the differences in management that lead to those conspicuous differences in deer density? I think there are differences in both forest management and differences in how they manage their wildlife. In terms of forest, the Menominee is famous for having a more long-rotation, sustainable, light-touch selective harvest system that may reduce habitat conditions that favor deer overabundance. In addition, however, they have a longer deer season. And there's more subsistence hunting in the Indian reservations. And I think a different attitude altogether. It's not just after the big rack. I think they may be more likely to take does. Do you know of any data on that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Yeah. Anyway, I think they have a more holistic approach to how they manage forests and wildlife. I think we could be learning some more things about it. Those are good questions, and I think some of us should follow up on them.
Next question. You had one in the back of the room?
No.
Okay. Anybody else right here, sir?
My name is John Porter. For this discussion, I'm just the person who grew up in northern Wisconsin. The forest practices in the north have changed some as the paper companies who were large landholders and who pulped that land constantly, providing a lot of new browse and feed for deer have given up those forests. Has that affected the deer population in the north at all, or their ability to harvest them? Don, maybe you can answer that.
The question specifically has to do with changing land ownership practices, but with a focus on the pulp and paper holdings that are now transitioning more into private hands.
Well, I think they have been in private hands, but you're right. There's been a lot of turnover, a lot of buying and selling. Plum Creek, I believe, is now the largest landowner in the state of Wisconsin. There is a big fall off in demand for newsprint and some other paper products. There's more stuff coming in from Canada. So I think rates of harvesting may be coming down a bit. I don't know the details. I think it's a little early to tell how that's going to affect deer populations. I know in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they've had some of the most severe deer overpopulation down near Menominee Marinette in Menominee County, Michigan, and Delta County nearby. And as they're moving out of that area in terms of timber harvest, more up into the middle and northern UP, there are a lot of concerns among the Michigan DNR and myself that we'll see boosting and deer populations up there and associated impacts. So another good question. These impacts vary over time and they vary over space, and we need to understand that a bit better.
I'd like to add to that. I think it does impact hunter access too, because as these large paper companies sell off their parcels and they become privatized, some of the landowners then don't allow public access. And in Wisconsin, you have the Managed Forest Law program that many of the paper companies have their lands enrolled in, and that's to maintain a healthy forest. But as part of that, they get a tax reduction, but they also are required to open those lands to public access for hunting and fishing and wildlife use. So if these lands are then sold off to private individuals, they can take them out of the MFL program, and then access becomes more limited again.
Next question. Right here, please.
Yeah, I'm Fran Ryan, a freelance writer from Western Massachusetts. And I'm wondering, what effect does this chronic wasting disease in the deer population have, if any, on the animals that might be preying on the deer or hunters that might be taking them?
Thank you. The question was, what impact does CWD have on predators that may prey on CWD-positive deer?
Well, chronic wasting disease, very similar to mad cow disease, the scrapie in sheep, at the TSC, as Tony mentioned earlier before. So far as I know, research has shown that this type of prion or TSC in deer, chronic wasting disease is specific to cervids, or in other words, deer, elk, moose. There hasn't been any research to show that it can show up in predators or people. However, there's health experts that still recommend caution consuming positive meat. As far as predators goes, while they may not become infected themselves, they may be spreading the disease through their feces after they eat infected meat. So that's that's a possibility for spread.
Next question here in front.
I'm Steve Holt. I'm a photographer from Oregon. What kind of quantitative difference is there between a fern park and a healthy forest in terms of carrying capacity of deer? Is it vastly reduced, or is it?
It's seriously reduced. And I emphasized, I'm a botanist, I emphasize the impact on the plant communities, but Leopold and many of the rest of us are also quite concerned with what happens to habitat quality for deer when you have severe overbrowsing sustained for as long as the Allegheny Plateau area has. So it goes down. I mean, the reason those ferns are there is because they generally resist herbivory by deer. They don't provide good forage. So the deer have a consequence of moving the forest to a condition that, in general, will work to their detriment. And I don't know about starvation rates, if those are monitored regularly by the DNR, but I think we're running into or facing a situation in the future where we may see more starving deer in the woods. The level of feeding in northern Wisconsin is extraordinary. You can't go by, you know, a convenience station up there without seeing huge bags of potatoes and carrots and corn and one thing and another. And, I mean, hundreds of tons of this stuff are put out to the point where Keith McCaffrey, a DNR wildlife biologist, thinks it's significantly enhancing overwinter survival. He's worried that deer are being sustained at such high levels up there, in part because of all this feeding that people are giving them. So even though habitat conditions may be deteriorating, the deer get sustained anyway.
I'd like to add to that a little bit. Maybe Don has some numbers on this, but I wonder how high the population would have to get before it actually did experience some type of starvation collapse. I know that in northern Wisconsin, the deer populations are a lot lower, and you're right, they probably get artificially enhanced by the additional baiting and feeding, but there's not nearly as much heavy agriculture up there. It's more heavily forested. and the winters are more severe, plus there are more natural predators of black bears prey on the fawns, and there's now a pretty significant wolf population, whereas in southern Wisconsin, where the agriculture is so great, there's huge corn, soybean, and alfalfa fields, and essentially no large predators like that, so that can be why you see these aerial survey numbers of 185 deer per square mile. These animals take a very severe winter to have any kind of starvation losses when there's so much agriculture going on.
Next question. Yes. Please do it.
I'd like to get your thoughts on the urban deer crisis, if you will. I'm interested in your take on why, you know, if they go in and do the science and they show that, you know, an urban area has too many deer, they can't go about getting the herd. Is it strictly emotion because these animals are beautiful, or is there anything else at work?
Question is, and we repeat the questions because this is being taped and sometimes the voice doesn't come through, but I'll repeat this one especially because it was in the back of the room. Urban deer populations are a big problem, and the question is what prevents areas from doing more control in urban areas? I suppose Jason should address it, and maybe Don and Jason.
Well, in short, it's a very social issue. The challenge is, again, there's various perspectives within the hunting community, but also the non-hunting community. I guess it has a lot to do with society's perception of hunting, and a lot of it also has to do with the perceived risk of safety if you allow hunting in these urban areas. While you have very small parcel or lot sizes, safety can be a concern, especially when there's a house or a property not very far away from a heavily populated area with deer. So a lot of the times these problems are resolved with town boards and within those communities. So especially when it's within a municipality, the DNR doesn't really have any control. That's decided on a more local level. And they can decide to solve the solution by applying for nuisance permits, to hire sharpshooters, or another solution may be to allow archery hunting within urban areas. It just depends on the community, so those are some solutions. Contraceptives and deer have been tried in the past. Very, very expensive and time-consuming program, and usually not as effective, but yes, it is becoming an increasing problem, and deer are very, very adaptable to urban areas where there's a lot of food and where they know they're safe. So,
nice job, Jason. I don't have much to add. There, you can hire White Buffalo Incorporated to come in with night vision equipment, silencers on the rifles, and take out your deer. And it's expensive, but not as expensive as these often failed efforts to translocate or use contraception against deer. Community after community, the richer ones across the United States, have gone through these non-lethal control methods and found that they consistently fail and have ended up using lethal methods. But we still have a lot of problem with suburbs full of deer.
I'll just quickly mention, in the Midwest, Duluth has employed an archery hunt in recent years with pretty good success in the Midwest. Duluth, Minnesota. And some other Wisconsin communities are considering implementing it. Your question, please.
Yeah, Dave Spratt again. I'm from Michigan, where we have a lot of the same deer population problems, especially in the southern part of the state, as Wisconsin. And what seems to be happening there is there's this kind of groundswell of quality deer management proponents who kind of see the value of trying to get the herd closer to its carrying capacity, and you know, it's really attracting the attention of a lot of young hunters who, you know, weren't around back in the day when the ethic of, you know, you can't shoot a dope because that makes you a sissy kind of thing. You know, they're not tied into any of that. So, and in the places where that's kind of spreading, they've really seen a marked improvement, and mostly it's just an educational effort. And so I wonder if Wisconsin as a state is promoting any of those kind of things or having any conversations with the Quality Deer Management Association or other groups that have a similar approach. And then Tony, I think after Jason talks about that, could you talk about where the groups you are involved with stand on issues like that?
Sure. Yeah, the question is quality deer management, is that embraced or advocated by our Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin?
Well, lately the term quality deer management has been thrown around quite loosely. And it can be perceived as many different ways, whether if it's from the organization itself or just the idea of the practice. And there's very various fundamentals involved with those programs. Often quality deer management advocates for antlerless harvest or managing the population at responsible levels. So as an agency, you know, that that jives with the population goals. That's an excellent thing. Quality deer management also advocates for, again, this is not always the case, but many of the philosophies advocate for altering the age structure of the herd through allowing deer to live older, particular bucks, I should say. There's the philosophy, let them grow. Let them go, let them grow. As far as altering the age structure, it really does not have much to do with deer herd health. It's just a perception or desired outcome that's really not embraced by the Department of Natural Resources. It doesn't, again, the foundation is these population goals, and that's the practice of, you know, whether or not one harvests a buck, you know, it's totally up to a landowner, and that's left up to them, or a hunter, I should say.
Tony Grabsky responding. I think that Jason touched on this a little bit, but people have different perspectives on what quality deer management really is, and if you follow the directives that quality deer management actually preaches, they do tell hunters to maintain a healthy herd structure with closer to a 1-to-1 buck to doe ratio, and certainly shoot quite a few antlerless deer and keep the herd into manageable levels. But there are other people that have their own perception of quality deer management, and that's given, I guess, the association a bad name in some cases, where quality deer management is just used as a euphemism for trophy buck management, and they say, oh, that's a bunch of guys that are rich landowners that hog all the deer for themselves so they can grow big racks. Well, that's not really what quality deer management tells you to do. And the state agency, at least one of the researchers that's been mentioned a couple times, Keith McCaffrey, I think he had a negative view of trophy buck management probably because of that. And if people follow what quality deer management tells you to do, you're not just managing for giant bucks. You're trying to keep the herd in balance.
Thanks. Next question. We've got about 5 minutes left. Yes?
I'm Dawn Stover. I'm a freelancer from Washington today. And I've been writing some recently about human-cougar conflicts, and one of the things in the West that seems to be creating some of the conflict is deer populations that are drawn into suburbs by habitat improvements to deer habitat made by the people who live there. And I'm wondering, this is another education question, I guess, is there, aside from education of hunters, is there an education effort here to try to help landowners understand how feeding deer and how not fencing gardens and creating more kind of deer-friendly habitat in suburb may be
Thank you. The question is there an educational effort in Wisconsin to help people understand how feeding of deer and gardens and things can contribute to the urban and suburban deer problem?
Well, as far as baiting and feeding goes, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has quite a few resources on our website that are available regarding the effects of baiting and feeding. So there are educational efforts. However, it's something we're looking more into, and we think it is important, not just with the hunting community, but the non-hunting community as well. As you mentioned, cougars are not as big of an issue in Wisconsin. They do exist, but at very, very low levels. Wolves can be an issue. Northern Wisconsin, increased baiting and feeding does attract wolves. If the deer are attracted area, wolves are attracted to those areas too. So that is definitely a communication point too that we're advocating.
Yes.
Chris Anderson. Historically, when deer populations were low, or with maybe some of the more where in areas where we were successful in coming close to eradicating deer or reducing the numbers down so they were low, what's the response of too few deer on the landscape? What's the response of native plants and wildlife when you have low deer population? What does it do?
Thank you. Question is, what is the response of the land to a low deer population?
Yeah. I'd recommend visiting Raspberry Island or one of the other outer islands up in the Apostle Islands, Michipicoten as well, I've heard, although I haven't been there. You need a snowshoe to walk over the U. I mean, it's really dense. And you saw from that exclosure picture, if you were here early, that I showed, that you get much denser understory vegetation. There's some work in Haida Gwaii in the Queen Charlotte Islands off the coast of British Columbia to suggest that areas that have that dense understory are much better for ground nesting and low shrub and low tree nesting birds. They're concerned about ancient murrelets out there and other threatened species. But more generally, the dramatic nature of the difference they saw between deer population, between bird populations on islands with and without deer, led them to suggest that maybe part of the reason we've seen continent-wide declines in neotropical migrant songbirds in North America may be related to the overall deer overabundance problem and the fact that a lot of birds are probably suffering reduced populations from the loss of the midstory and understory. That's a provocative hypothesis and it needs to be tested, but I think there may be onto something.
Yes, we'll take these last two questions then.
Katie Ember again. It's another education question. I guess I live in Illinois, and I've sort of just heard in conversation more people seem to understand that deer overpopulation is a problem and are concerned about their gardens being eaten and that sort of thing. And I just wonder if there's an effort by the DNR to sort of take advantage of that growing awareness that, you know, vehicle collisions are a problem, Lyme disease is a problem, and try to get communities to embrace lethal control in their area.
Great. Question is the DNR trying to take utilize the growing public awareness of things like Lyme disease and damage to shrubs to increase public acceptance of lethal control?
Well, as far as the methods of control of deer population goes, again, that's a very social issue. If it's in an urban area, the solutions are going to need to come from those areas, town boards, the community, etc. So the department isn't going to advocate for lethal control. That's going to need to be decided by those local communities. The deer management occurs on a very wide unit by unit basis, which encompasses a much larger area, and that goal is transformed to those areas as well. And that's as far as the most detailed management or approach the department's going to encourage.
Thanks.
This is more of a people question, but cooperation between hunters and the DNR is kind of like a critical tool in the deer management box, and it seems like there's just a huge rift between the hunting, or at least parts of the hunting population in Wisconsin and the DNR. What are you going to do? That's got to be solved at some point, right? I guess Jason and Tony probably both have a point of view on how to make that happen.
Great. The question is, how can the department work with hunters to improve hunter DNR relations to manage the deer herd?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that Wisconsin prides itself on is public involvement. We have various stakeholder groups representing various parts of the hunting community and non-community that are involved with deer management. Like I mentioned before, we did our deer management unit review process that's currently ongoing, waiting for legislative approval. Also, we had a stakeholder group assigned by the Natural Resources Board to look at alternatives to the Earn a Buck program, which is a very highly contentious issue, so we're looking for alternatives to that. There's just a continuous public feedback process, but it's very, very difficult. The thing is we just have to find common ground, a lot of compromise, and hunters have a very big influence in deer management policy, and they should.
Yeah, I'll add to that. I think that when it comes to deer hunting, it's hard to get even a group of hunters or people that you believe are your allies to agree, let alone hunters in the state agency. Everybody has a little bit different opinion on what's best for their deer hunting methods. And Wisconsin has some unique organizations that help facilitate that cooperation between hunters, landowners, and the agency. We have the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, and I'm a member of that. There's five delegates in each of the 72 counties in the state, and we come up with recommendations for hunting, fishing, and wildlife environmental rules and communicate those to then the Natural Resources Board, and eventually they go up through the DNR and onward to the legislature, and Wisconsin's the only state that has that. And I think cooperation has advanced between the agency and the hunters, but deer hunting's such a contentious issue, I think you can't satisfy all the people all the time.
I'd just like to add a postscript there. I agree with you. I think the rift between hunters and the DNR is a critical issue. Credibility and a sense of common purpose are really essential if we're going to get anywhere on these issues. So I would just like to throw out a couple of suggestions. One is to move hunter safety or the hunter education a bit away from just gun safety, the emphasis that it has, more towards what's the ecological role of hunting playing as predation in the system, a little bit on the science of deer management, so there'd be more of an understanding of the limitations and power of that approach. And then secondly, I'd like to see a lot more, comment about all those tracking cameras out in the woods and all that hunter information about where the deer are and what they look like. I mean, why aren't we collecting that data together? Why aren't we working with the hunters to collect the data that managers and scientists too need to know what's going on in the woods? I think that collaborative effort shows a lot of potential for really building that sense of common purpose between the two groups.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for attending. That concludes our session.